From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Republican Senator Charles Grassley is predicting today that a deal could be announced tomorrow to avert U.S. tariffs on Mexican goods, tariffs that President Trump threatened last week in another bid to force Mexico to do more about illegal immigration. The Mexican foreign minister is meeting with the Trump administration today in Washington. And earlier today, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro started walking back the threat of tariffs on CNN.
We believe that these tariffs may not have to go into effect precisely because we have the Mexicans' attention.
NPR chief economic correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy.
So many Republican senators oppose these tariffs. Does it look like there may just be too much pressure from the right for President Trump to carry through with them?
I don't think there's too much pressure. There's no question that Republican senators are unhappy with the idea of these tariffs, but it's not at all clear that they have the political numbers that they would need to actually vote down the tariffs in the event of a presidential veto, especially because that would also require a two-thirds vote in the House. And House Republicans seem to be a little bit more willing to go along with the president. What is true is that the senators have some leverage that Trump might respect, and that is he needs their support to pass the new NAFTA agreement that he has struck with Mexico and Canada. You might remember a few weeks ago, Senator Grassley insisted that unless the president ended the steel and aluminum tariffs on Canada and Mexico, that new NAFTA deal was dead on arrival in the Senate. And pretty soon, the president got religion and did, in fact, withdraw the steel and aluminum tariffs. But here we go again. He's back to his tariffing ways.
Well, you're calling it the new NAFTA deal. It's also called, the president would call it, the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And speaking of that deal, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, today said she met with the Mexican delegation and talked about that.
The meeting that we had was very respectful. Praised the relationship between our two countries, made clear that we wanted to pass, we're trying to go to yes on U.S. Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
So how does the agreement really fit into this tariff discussion beyond the fact that, as you say, that the president is going to need the Senate to say yes to it?
Well, it does create this sort of weird juxtaposition of being talking about a free trade agreement at the same time you're threatening to level 25% tariffs on your next door neighbor. But what we can say about both the new NAFTA and the old NAFTA is that they both work to build a very highly integrated North American economy. The auto industry is just one example of that. But our economy here in the United States is closely integrated, interwoven with the economy of Mexico. And that's why these tariffs that the president is threatening to impose would be felt very strongly on both sides of the border.
Now, if people are feeling deja vu here in terms of the president making the threat of tariffs, and then now we're starting to see some backing off by the White House, he did just a couple of months ago threaten to close down the entire Mexican border if Mexico didn't stop all illegal immigration in a week. And then he didn't shut the border down, and obviously they didn't stop all illegal immigration at that time. In this case, is there evidence that Mexico is doing anything different?
Mexico has stepped up its efforts to address the migration, which is mostly coming from Central America, but through Mexico. They have taken steps to deport more Central Americans who are in Mexico. They are also playing host to some Central American families who are seeking asylum in the U.S., but have been allowed to remain in Mexico while they await their legal processing. So Mexico has taken some steps in that direction. It hasn't gone nearly as far as President Trump would like to see.
And are you saying that they've taken those steps just in the last few days or over the last few weeks and months?
I think they've been taking those steps before the president made this newest tariff threat.
Scott, the president, as we've talked about, is fighting numerous fronts in trade wars, not just with Mexico, but also with China, with Europe, with other countries around the world. Is there any sense at this point of whether this strategy of putting in tariffs to try to get concessions is working or you know, what the strategy is exactly?
I think there is a broad strategy. Whether it's working is another matter. The president clearly has a strategy. He likes tariffs, and his strategy is to blow up the international trading system with tariffs or the threat of tariffs while making demands on our trading partners for concessions. He's done this repeatedly with Japan, with Canada, with Mexico, with the European Union. So far, he has only one actual trade deal with South Korea to show for all this. And then, of course, there is that new NAFTA that's sort of on deck. He's talked about doing deals with Europe. He's talked about doing deals with a post-Brexit UK, a deal with Japan. But it's just premature to say whether any of that's going to work out.
NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, to the measles outbreak, according to the CDC, new cases have hit a 25-year high, what's being called vaccine hesitancy, a fear of shots. Despite their proven safety, is part of the problem. But new data show a bigger concern, kids who just aren't getting their shots, period. Dr. Cindy Weinbaum is Deputy Director, Immunization Services Division at the CDC in Atlanta. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you.
And the numbers are pretty stunning. In 10 states, unvaccinated students who didn't get some sort of an exemption outnumbered by far the kindergartners who did get one, say, for religious beliefs. In Ohio, for instance, 15,000 had the exemption based on religious beliefs. 27,000 had no exemption at all. Why aren't they getting their shots?
The main reason is really just because of some sort of a barrier to access of vaccines. Mm-hmm. We have found that among kids who haven't gotten vaccines, they are much more likely to have no insurance than kids who have gotten vaccines. Kids who live in places that are not cities, that is, in rural areas, are more likely to not get shots. Kids who have private insurance are much more likely to have all their shots than kids who are on public insurance. And we have seen these differences by race, ethnicity, and poverty status over a number of years.
Well, for instance, I'm going to jump in. Arkansas has the highest percentage of kindergarten students enrolled without complete vaccinations and without any of these medical or religious or philosophical exemptions. This is, again, the CDC stats. Ohio, you know, that figure goes to 5.3%. That's the second highest. But then in Arkansas, as you just indicated, most children are on Medicaid for low-income residents, and 16 of the counties there have only the local health department for vaccinations. They don't have a doctor's office or a clinic, so it is an access issue.
That's right. This is one thing that CDC is looking into much more closely to try and see what are some of the strategies that we might be able to use in order to get these kids vaccinated.
And a lot of these under-vaccinated kids, I think in 10 states, were allowed to come to school as kindergartners because schools are in a tough position. They know the school is the safest place for most kids. But we know that according to CDC thinking, you want to have 95% of people, you know, a group of people, children, vaccinated in order to prevent an outbreak. Here, it feels like you have much less. What are your concerns?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that we do aim to have 95% of kids vaccinated with MMR vaccine in order to prevent outbreaks. On the other hand, as you've said, it is important for kids to be in school. So the states have a very delicate walk to do in order to make sure that their kids are in school and to follow up in order to make sure that they get those vaccines.
And I think we need to say it every time. Again, we're learning through your data that a lot of children are not vaccinated, not because the parents don't believe in vaccinations. It's because they are very busy. It's hard to access. But those who might be saying, I'm hesitant, what's the importance of a measles vaccination?
Well, measles vaccine is a safe and effective way of preventing measles. Measles can lead to very dangerous health outcomes, such as pneumonias and encephalitis. Measles vaccine has been given to millions and millions of kids safely, and it really is the best way to prevent measles from spreading in a community.
The CDC has warned that if this outbreak continues at this pace, by September, the beginning of the school year, this country may no longer be classified as a country that has eradicated measles. How significant is that?
Well, that is definitely significant. We would really be sad to lose our elimination status that has been hard won over many years. There are really three pillars to increasing immunization. Number one, as you said, is really decreasing barriers to access for immunization. Number two is identifying these local pockets of low vaccination coverage. And third, as I'm sure you know, there is easy access to vaccine misinformation. And part of the role of CDC is to try and counter these false safety and effectiveness claims about vaccines and provide healthcare providers with the information and resources that they need in order to communicate best with their patients about the science behind vaccines.
Dr. Weinbaum, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Dr. Cindy Weinbaum, Deputy Director at the Immunization Services Division of the CDC in Atlanta.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
This is Treat You Better by the Australian electronic dance trio Rufus Du Sol. They're on a world tour promoting their third album, Solace, after their first two albums rose to the top of the Australian charts. I saw them at Coachella in California this year, and I'm glad to welcome them now to Here and Now. Tyrone Lindquist, John George, and James Hunt join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
So let's talk about how you do what you do, or what do you think that you're bringing to this kind of music that other people are not? Because one of the things that I hear when I listen, and I'll put this to you, Tyrone, is the emotion in your voice, whether you want to be happy or be sad or whatever emotion as a listener that you're feeling at that moment, I can hear it in your voice and it translates through the music. So tell me about that and that part of what you're doing.
I wouldn't consider myself much of a singer, really. I think we tend to lean towards like a vulnerable, relaxed tone that isn't pushed too much. I'm not really sure how to put it, but it feels probably similar to like an actor on screen not giving a lot, just, you know, getting to see the actor on the screen, getting to see their face, not do a whole lot of things. The audience gets to interpret a certain amount of emotion from them. I feel like it's similar in the way that I sing. Like, it isn't too on the nose. And I think it allows for the listener to just interpret a little bit of what the song is meaning.
Please don't forget who I am when I'm gone. I hope that you remember me.
A lot of people have said that your latest album is darker. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I guess we do agree with that. And that wasn't really like a thing that we set out to do when we started writing the record. But I think having written the first two records, having a little bit more experience under our belt as producers and songwriters, initially, you know, maybe we had a better ability to capture certain moods, but also the environment we were writing in. You know, we'd set up the studio in Venice in California, where the studio was attached to the house we were living in. So it was a really fun time. We'd set up this beautiful escapist wonderland to write in.
Yeah, you had a shaman come over, right, and set it up for you.
Yes, the infamous shaman. We did have a friend of ours who came in and, you know, imbued the studio with these these creative kind of little, like one corner would be the underwater corner, so there were seashells in there. There was a sort of outer space bit where he put fairy lights up. And initially it was like, oh, this is pretty funny, but it actually did transport the space into a little bit more of this escapist, you know, realm where we, you'd walk in and instantly be transported. And we were doing that from night to night. We were, you know, allowed to transport ourselves and write until the early morning. But I think the ability to keep going without limits definitely, you know, at times we found ourselves in some darker spots. You know, it was a little bit unhealthy at times, but also it was one of the most fun times we've had writing. So I think the spectrum of those emotions brought out some of that darkness, and we allowed that and let it breathe, I guess. So give me your everything, 'cause every time you look at me,
I see myself in your eyes. I want to ask you about the song Eyes, which you wrote during a retreat at Joshua Tree National Park in California, as I understand it. What was the process of writing that, and what were you trying to say with that song?
That trip to Joshua Tree was like a lyric writing trip. And we went, and we had like 3 days. We wrote a song. We wrote Lost in My Mind in like a day.
Wow.
And we wrote all the lyrics of Eyes there. And it was such a magical place to do it. It's like there's no people, no cars. You're just kind of in the middle of nowhere under the stars. And yeah, it really was, it made writing lyrics fun and very easy for us.
Well, and it sounds like even when you're in your home base of Los Angeles, you're able to kind of remove yourself from the world around you.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've always played with that idea of escapism when we write, losing ourselves in the songs. And yeah, we often do that in the studio.
I have to ask you about that because I've been listening to a lot of your music, especially since I saw you. And the song that I have gravitated toward the most is called Inner Bloom, which is like 9 minutes long, and it does so many things. And I wonder, because I've seen that you've talked about this song as being the kind of pinnacle so far of what you've written, what is it about Inner Bloom? What were you trying to do there?
Well, I think one of the beautiful things about the writing process is that every now and then we find ourselves with a song that just kind of presents itself and unfurls before you. And with Inner Bloom, that was one that just happened so sequentially and naturally, and we didn't overthink anything or, you know, reimagine anything. Even in terms of some of the vocal takes, we tried to re-record or sort of perfect them, but we ended up using these initial takes that had a little bit of, you know, raw emotion. And so that was just a really beautiful experience for us.
Well, I want to listen to a little bit because there's a part of it that I just love. Let's listen to this part here where the song just comes to a stop. So it sort of slows down there to a stop, and then it restarts itself up again. Here it is. Tell me about that.
I guess the Pechenga Boys, like, we like referencing other artists and artists that have influenced us. And the Pechenga Boys put out a song called Time a fair few years ago. Mm-hmm. And they use that sort of trick as well, where it sort of stops at a certain moment and they hold on a chord. And you think that it's over, and then it kind of ramps back up and you get this reprise. It's kind of like a bonus track or something, but it's still the same song. And that feeling was something we knew we wanted to explore as soon as we'd made the foundation of this song, like the start.
Is it hard to convince somebody, by the way, that you should do a 9 minute and 48 second song?
We didn't have to convince anyone, really. I mean, we knew we loved the song. We were really connected with it. We knew we wanted to close the album with it. But
I think also we do get pressure sometimes to, you know, make a track like 30 seconds shorter or something for radio. But this track in particular, everyone was very quiet about the time length. They're like, yep, that's it. That's the one.
You talked about escapism there, and I just wonder, especially for our audience, which pays a lot of attention to the news in the world today, do you guys pay attention to the news?
Yeah, a lot.
Does it ever influence the music that you're doing?
Read the news today. Oh, boy.
I don't think we speak about politics or news too often. We try to, I guess, we've seen some strange opinions or heard some strange opinions from different people across America, and it doesn't really influence the music, but our moods have certainly been through the same waves of emotion that most people would be experiencing here.
But you're able to escape it all to write what you write.
Yeah, that's exactly why we do what we do. We love being able to create our own little fantasy world. The same way an author would be writing a novel or something, you can just dive back into it and forget about everything, or at least, embrace some of those feelings and move forward.
Okay, so I have one more question for you, and it's kind of a silly question, but I see that you like something called Zambreros, which I guess is like an Australian Chipotle, is that right?
Yeah, it's like Australian Chipotle, and one of the signature things they do is they crush up corn chips, and you can put the crushed up corn chips in your salad or burrito, and it's a pretty hot tip.
Okay, so for each of you, if you could have a Zambreros burrito with one person, I'm going to ask each of you, who would it be with? Tyrone, I'll start with you.
Oh, maybe John Lennon.
Okay, I guess we're doing dead or alive here. That's fine. That's fine. Yeah. No problem. John, what about you?
I think maybe Tom York.
Tom York from Radiohead, yeah.
From Radiohead.
You took my answer, bro.
Okay, and James, what about you?
Well, I was going to say Tom York, but I guess now I'm going to say... maybe Nicholas Jaar. He's one of our favorite electronic producers, and I think it'll be a really good time.
Crushed up corn chips, too.
Crushed up corn chips.
All right, good. Well, I hope that you guys, at least, except for John Lennon, obviously, you're able to actually have the Zambreros burrito with the person of your choice. That is Rufus Du Sol. Guys, thank you so much for making the music that you make and for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Almost all of India is under a heat wave warning today, with severe heat warnings across northern and central India. The temperature reached 108 degrees Fahrenheit today in New Delhi, and earlier this week, temperatures reached 122 degrees in the city of Churu in the northern Indian state of Rajasthan. And that is where we find Narayan Barrett, who's a BBC contributor. He joins us from Jaipur. Narayan, what is it like where you are?
It's very difficult for a person like me. I born and brought up in the desert area. But this weather is causing so much problem with people. I spoke to Met Department officials. They're saying that there's a warning for people to take all cautions to protect themselves from the heat wave. And, the people are very experienced to handle the summer season. But this is unexpected and unusual when some district like Churu, they recorded high temperature in the last 10 days. There were two occasions when the Churu district recorded more than 50 degrees Celsius temperature that is making life very difficult for human being and also for animal.
50 degrees Celsius, it was about 122 degrees Fahrenheit there. That's the second highest on record in Churu. What are officials telling people to do? Because how much air conditioning access is there in that area?
Only those who are better economically, they can afford air conditioner and even fans. But poor, they cannot afford it. And the most difficult thing is the water availability. A lot of people getting ill. We have Jaipur, the biggest hospital of the state. Every day, 70 people reaching with some waterborne diseases or some heat wave related diseases. So, you know, Rajasthan is the biggest state in terms of geographical area in this country. But we have only 1% surface water of India.
Only 1% of the surface water in all of India.
Yeah. Most of the well dried up and the hand pumps are not producing water this time.
And it's also been a very dry year in India this year. I think the second driest where you are on record.
Yes, it's the most dry time. And there is no chances of any respite from the heat wave. The authorities issued advisory to people not to come out in the daytime and continuously take drinking water so you can protect yourself from the heat wave.
Right. So when is there going to be some relief? I know you're waiting for the monsoon season to start. It has been delayed. It's been very dry, as we said, over the past few months. So when might you get some relief from the heat?
I think the Rajasthan, we welcome the monsoon on 21st of June or 22 or 23. So in daytime, you cannot see in the sky, but when evening comes, people look at the sky and offer prayers for the monsoon rain so they can get some relief.
So you can't even pray for rain during the day. It's so hot. That is Narayan Barrett, who is a BBC contributor in Rajasthan in northern India, where it is extremely hot as they continue to deal with a heat wave there. Narayan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
At a ceremony in England today commemorating tomorrow's 75th anniversary of D-Day, 99-year-old British veteran John Jenkins looked back.
I'm honoured to be stood here today in front of so many other veterans. You never forget your comrades because we're all in it together.
D-Day was the largest naval, air, and land invasion in history, what our next guest calls the Big War, fought by the Allies on the land, in the air, on the sea, while the Germans were forced to fight largely on land. But fight they did at daybreak on June 6, 1944, as wave after wave of British, American, and Canadian troops landed on five different beaches along the Normandy coastline. They were met with, mowed down by the full force of German troops in a battle that went on for nearly 6 weeks. You may have seen it in movies like Saving Private Ryan or The Longest Day, but the movies don't tell the whole story, and soon those who lived through it won't tell it at all. Historians like James Holland will. He's a British historian. His new book is called Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. He joins us now. James, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And can you give us context? France had fallen to the Germans. In fact, in 1944, Nazi Germany had occupied much of Europe for 4 years and had invaded Russia as well. Britain, amazingly, had held off the Nazi bombings. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the U.S., 3 years earlier, 1941. But you have these allies, the British, the U.S., Canada. They knew they had to, like, to use a sports metaphor, they had to throw the long ball. They had to do something big.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, right from the word go, both the U.S. and the British were absolutely determined that they were going to use steel, not flesh, as far as possible, and fight using their assets and prioritizing correctly. So, you know, both Britain and America have huge industrial power, huge global reach, modernity, science, and they were going to harness all of that and resources to fight a war which was going to be industrially heavy, very mechanized. That's very different to how everybody else was fighting. You know, the Germans, the Russians, the Japanese, it's all about boots on the ground. You know, it's about numbers of manpower, really, more than anything else.
Well, when you say innovation, one of my treasured keepsakes is a little black and white photo I have of General James Gavin. He was standing with, I think, General Eisenhower in a field in the Midwest. And it was Gavin who came up with the idea of putting troops in parachutes and parachuting troops in. So there was innovation there. There was, as you say, all the steel. They pretty much held off the German aircraft. So the Germans were forced to just fight with what they had on the ground.
Well, one of the key things about D-Day, one of the key prerequisites was to make sure that they had completely control of the airspace over the, not just the invasion, planned invasion beaches, but over most of Northwest Europe. And they pulled it off. And they pulled it off by having superior aircraft, more aircraft, better tactics, higher skilled pilots. And on the face of it, you'd have thought the Germans would win because they're already on land, whereas the Allies have got to get it across the English Channel. So that's where air power comes in, because you've got to destroy all the bridges, destroy their communication network, destroy their radar, roads, locomotives, and all the rest of it, and slow up the Germans' ability to strengthen the bridgehead in Normandy. And they managed to do that incredibly successfully.
Well, you say, in fact, we should pay more attention to what happened in the air. But it's hard to when we've seen these images of what happened on the ground. We see wave after wave of these troops just spilling out of containers onto the beaches where they were just mowed down. But you remind us that Allied leaders, this was so important to turn back the Nazis at this point, that they were braced for as many as 40,000 casualties on the first day alone. It was 10,000, but still, that's enormous. And then, you know, 6,000 a day, again, in injured, wounded, and dead.
Two of the things that really struck me on my research was, one, that, you know, it wasn't like the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan across the board, not even on Omaha Beach. And even in the first wave, which is what that's supposed to be depicting, i.e. the troops that are landing at 6:30 in the morning, it wasn't a wholesale slaughter. And if you look at after action reports, it's quite interesting because officers, platoon commanders are saying, you know, cross beach with one dead and two wounded and this kind of thing. It just depended on where you landed and what time you landed, to be perfectly honest. There were two kind of particularly bad killing zones for the Americans and very much in those first waves. But if you look at pictures of troops landing at 10 in the morning, they're getting off the beaches, you know, really without too much trouble.
Well, thank
and
God.
You have to remember what it's like for the Germans. You know, it was horrific, don't get me wrong, and I'm not trying to belittle it in any way. But, you know, if you're a German defender, there was kind of 350 of you on the crust at Omaha Beach, and you're being attacked by 183 offshore naval guns, in as well as vast numbers of cannons, plus the troops on the ground. You know, smoke soon obscures you from your firing line with your machine gun. There's grit coming down in your bunker and dust, and, you know, your barrels are overheating in your machine gun. So it's horrific for the first waves, and particularly those first waves on those particularly tough killing zones, but thereafter the fighting at Omaha Beach starts to ease quite substantially. Total Allied dead on Omaha Beach, and some really good recent work has been done into this, is 842, which is a heck of a lot, don't get me wrong. And I'm not, again, I'm not trying to belittle it in any shape or form, but I would suspect that most people think it's a lot worse than that.
Right.
And they do get a foothold pretty quickly. I would say that by kind of 9 o'clock in the morning, it's all over on Omaha Beach. Not the fighting. People are still getting killed well into the afternoon. It's still a kind of dangerous place to be. But the outcome is no longer in doubt. And they don't achieve all their D-Day objectives, but they do the important things. And the most important thing of all is that it doesn't fail. And boy, does it not fail. I mean, D-Day is a huge success.
How big a deal is that?
Had the Allies failed on D-Day, I think there would have been terrible consequences. They wouldn't have been able to mount another amphibious invasion on that scale anytime soon. And that means that the war in Europe would have probably gone nuclear, because that was what the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb, was designed for initially, later used on the Japanese, but initially designed for the for Germany. And there is also the prospect of the Iron Curtain that followed with the Cold War and the dominance of the Soviet Union and communism across a swathe of Europe would have been much further west, both of which are kind of not nice prospects. Yeah. So it really was absolutely important for post-war liberty and freedom and the development of Europe and the world as and the democratic powers that that invasion took place and succeeded. And thank goodness it did.
Well, I'm trying to put it into context. You know, it's hard to think of today a country, you know, ravaging Europe as Germany was, and then another country attacking the U.S. as Japan did. And having to make this decision what to do. And you had people like Dwight Eisenhower, I mentioned, the general who was also the future American president, Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, pulling together. You have these alliances that were formed and seemed sacred. And today, just your thoughts, you have maybe a pulling away from that alliance. You have President Trump, who has considered pulling out of NATO, that military alliance. You know, just your sense of the memory of that time and its legacy, and is it maybe changing?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question and such an interesting point, because I think one of the things that really struck me when I was working on this book was the totality of effort. You know, what the allies are doing, they're coalition partners, they're not formal allies, and they're pulling together. Everyone is honed towards this goal. It is, the logistics of it are absolutely mind-numbing, and they pull it off with bells on, frankly. I think what's interesting and why one should always study history is that history doesn't repeat itself, but patterns of human behavior do. And what you saw after the Wall Street crash and global depression in 1929 and the early 1930s is this rise of nationalism and splintering of the old political order. And what you've seen post-2008 is a similar sort of thing. So we live in troubling times at the moment. And, you know, society is splintering again. I mean, we're incredibly divided at the moment in the UK. There's divisions, I know, in the USA and across the whole of Europe. And what I hope out of the 75th anniversary is that it focuses minds on what actually really is really important and what we value in this life, which is freedom and liberty. And I know that this week, the surviving veterans will be rightly treated like rock stars. You know, they'll be commemorating, but celebrating that freedom. And it's really important that we don't forget it, because I tell you what, you can lose it just like that if you're not careful. So it should be a lesson, a warning, and a remembrance of the huge sacrifice that was made to ensure that we have had these long years of peace in Europe and the Western world ever since.
That's historian James Holland. His new book is Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. James, thank you so much for an important reminder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Last October, Jewish worshippers in Pittsburgh were the target of the deadliest anti-Semitic attack on American soil. In the days after the Tree of Life shooting, Pittsburghers started using a phrase that both inspired and described the community's response: stronger than hate. But as Liz Reed from member station WESA reports, putting that maxim into practice requires a big shift in human nature.
The phrase was used by politicians like Mayor Bill Peduto the day after the shooting on the Today Show.
And I hope that everyone does understand that Pittsburgh is stronger than hate.
Celebrities like Pittsburgh native Michael Keaton standing in the rain at a rally.
If you want to see a city that's far, far much stronger than hate, you should go to Pittsburgh.
The alleged shooter was charged with a hate crime, which the FBI describes as being motivated by a bias against someone's race, religion, gender, or other protected factor. And University of Pittsburgh sociologist Kathleen Blee says that animus is often an expression of fear.
It's a fear rooted in a sense of vulnerability.
Blee has spent much of her career studying white supremacist groups.
It's important to say that the vulnerability in general is not actually true, but it's a perceived vulnerability.
One way that fear manifests is the conspiracy theory of white genocide, embraced by white nationalists and others. The theory holds that white people are being replaced by immigrants and people of color, and Blee says that message can be appealing to someone who's feeling vulnerable, like their life isn't going well.
It's sort of, here's why it's not, because there are these forces that are targeting you, that are making your life difficult, and it's given a sense of urgency. And when it becomes very urgent, that's where you have the terrible potential for violent outbursts.
At a busy corner in Pittsburgh's Squirrel Hill neighborhood, beyond a chain link fence, behind a glass window, 11 white paper stars of David bear the names of the Tree of Life shooting victims.
This place is yet another reminder of where this ideology ends up.
Tony McAleer is co-founder of the group Life After Hate. He once believed the same ideology that fueled the attack on the synagogue. He says deep down, the emotion that motivated him to become a neo-Nazi wasn't hate or even fear. It was shame.
I felt less than myself, and so I adopted an ideology that told me I was greater than.
McAleer points to childhood trauma as being at the root of his shame, and his experience is not an isolated one. The National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism found that childhood trauma is a risk factor for becoming involved in an extremist group. Researchers note that the vast majority of people who experience childhood trauma will not become violent extremists. But for those who do, extremist groups can provide stability.
I got a sense of belonging. I got acceptance when I felt unlovable. I got attention when I felt invisible. And I got power when I felt powerless.
McAleer says his identity as a white supremacist began to unravel after his first child was born. He now works to help people leave white supremacist groups, and he says the key to that work is compassion.
When we're compassionate with someone, what we actually do is we hold the mirror up to them and allow them to see their humanity, their wholeness, reflected back at them when they can't see it or perceive it on their own.
McAleer's work is done on an individual scale, talking to one white supremacist at a time. But those who study childhood trauma advocate for a broader public health approach, says Dr. Sandra Bloom, a psychiatrist and public health professor at Drexel University.
We know that childhood adversity increases, and dramatically, in many cases, increases the risks for basically all of our major social problems. Mental health, health care, substance abuse, criminal justice, you name it.
Bloom's work is informed by the findings of a landmark 1998 study from Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. The policy implications could be monumental, says Bloom, because many of these adverse childhood experiences are preventable.
This is a big shift. This means really rethinking how we understand human nature.
The Reverend Paul Abernathy agrees.
How you doing? So good to see you.
Abernathy leads the Pittsburgh chapter of Focus North America, an Orthodox Christian community service group. His work is focused on interrupting the cycle of trauma with love.
It's not even about being stronger than hate. It is more even the power of love, the power of unconditional and redeeming love that we, each and every one of us, have to be committed to.
But translating those feelings into public policy is a challenge, says psychiatrist Sandra Bloom.
What we're trying to figure out is what are universal precautions around the issue of trauma.
That's the crux of a public health approach, prevention aimed at the entire population. Bloom says that's what governments and public agencies need to figure out. The task is daunting, she says, but doable.
We could stop what we do. We could decide as a species we are not going to engage in violence anymore because the price is too high.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Reed in Pittsburgh.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.